This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Welcome to episode 116 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Erin Campbell. My guest today is affectionately referred to as the Mad Scientist of Magic, who was inducted into the Pro Tour Hall of Fame in 2009. He is the one and only Frank Karsten. Hello.
Hi, Erin. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. I know I've said this to you before on Twitter, but I am a really, really big fan of yours.
Wow. Well, I'm glad to hear it.
And you can tell that I'm a fan of yours because I will read anything that you write. I think like a lot of people, I tend to only read what only affects me. Like if somebody's writing about a deck that I'm playing or a format that I'm playing, I will certainly read their articles. But you are somebody where you could write about the beer you had the other day, and I will probably read it because it's enjoyable to me.
Sure. Yeah, I might do a complete analysis of all the flavors that you can get here. Mathematical analysis of the ingredients, and well, why not? I'm happy that you enjoy the things I write.
Yeah, I definitely
feel. It means a lot to me.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you make things approachable to me. Like even though I don't play Affinity, I feel like I can understand what you're writing about. You know, you're clear, and I feel like that's something sometimes we don't see enough of, where people will write about another deck, and you know, they're not thinking of the people who don't play it or maybe who want to play it. They're writing solely for those who get it already, and I like your approach.
I like to explain my entire thought process, and often the. For example, the ideas behind deck building, they apply more generally than to just one deck. Mm-hmm. So I always try to put in some stuff for people who are not specifically interested in the exact topic at hand. But yeah, just some general thoughts. Mm-hmm. I'm happy that you like it.
Yeah, and you've been writing for a long time. You said you've been writing for a number of websites.
That's true. I started writing about like 10 years ago or something like that, for Brainburst, basically the old TCG player. Mm-hmm. It was just like a couple of other Dutch pro players were writing for the website, and I figured, well, might as well try it as well. So I wrote some tournament reports and started writing more. Eventually was asked to start for the Daily MTG website. There I did like an online tech column for a year, like a little over a year. Mm-hmm. Where the I actually got like a special account on Magic Online called Online Tech, and once every while I got some questions from people like, hi, hello, these are my computer specifications, can you help me figure out the settings? I'm like, well, I'm not actually tech support, I'm just writing a column that's called Online Tech, as in like the deck tech from from the Magic Online. But yeah, basically I analyzed the metagame changes on Magic Online for a while. This was way back when we kind of had to collect all the data on decks manually. It wasn't just there as it is right now.
Well, some would argue that it's still not there right now.
Yeah, well, the website for Wizards could probably be better. Let's keep it at that. And even then, it doesn't even include all the tournaments. But yeah, so I did that for a while. And roughly 1 or 2 years ago, I started writing for Channel Fireball. That's where I'm at right now. Like every 2 weeks on average, I have a column there. And I enjoy it a lot.
And where do you find your inspiration from? Because I mean, I had a blog for a number of years, and I had a hard time even coming up with things to write about without the pressure of a deadline or, you know, or being a regular content provider. You know, where do you come up with things to write about?
I think Magic itself, with its changing formats, all the new sets, just give a lot of topics by itself. I mean, when a new set comes out, you have a bunch of new cards to talk about. When a new set comes out, there are also a bunch of new decks that, well, trigger some thought. You can write about that too. And, well, when I'm not writing about current decks or new cards, I sometimes tackle some theoretical topics as well, which is mainly inspired by, I guess, questions I've always had myself. Mm-hmm. Like when you try to build a deck, I always wonder, like, what's the best mana base? Or what's the best mana curve? Mm-hmm. And just taking those questions that I found when I was trying to play a game or building a deck, that kind of fills the inspiration for the topics that I write about.
Yeah. I know. Speaking of theory, I read your post about the mana bases, about, you know, how many of each fetch you should have and how many of each tri-land you should have. And that was pretty big. Like, I know several other writers who will, you know, when they're talking about a deck that they're building in their columns, they will reference you and they will say, Frank Carson says that we need to have this many lands and we need to be able to cast this by that. And that was a big deal, that article or two.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised by the, by the support and how often it's referenced, but I guess it kind of filled a gap that no one ever really talked about. Mm-hmm. With many people doing deck building kind of based on intuition or looking at previous decks, how people did it, and then just copying it, rather than kind of looking at the underlying probabilities and mathematics that go into maximizing certain things. Mm-hmm. And, well, I'm glad that I was able to add something to that. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to mana bases in particular, like often when my team asks, like, how should we build the mana base, you just come to me and give me a deck and then I'll tweak the mana base and then give it back to them. Yeah, it's a skill that many people don't really... it's kind of a puzzle, I guess, that many people don't really like to solve. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy puzzles, and, well, this is one that I like in particular.
Are there times where you find yourself looking at deck lists, and because you have this knowledge of the mana base, you see other people's mana bases, and you're like, this is painful, what are they doing?
Yes, sometimes. and then it especially pains me when, that deck list gets copied a lot, because I kind of know that people who copy it will... Yeah, get mana screwed more frequently or something like that. And that's just a pity because that doesn't lead to fun games of Magic for anyone. On the other hand, like, maybe sometimes my requirements are a bit too strict on mana bases, and people who stretch it can also gain some advantages. So I shouldn't always cringe so much when I look at mana bases. But there have certainly been times where I looked at a deck or like a deck tech video, and I look at the mana base and I'm like, oh no, yeah, done watching. This is it. Play it away.
Do you think that that's something we don't see enough of nowadays, Frank, is people delving into the theory of things and the probability of things and just going by, like you said, going by instinct, going by what somebody else did, and instead of themselves looking at their pile and doing, you know, that math for themselves? Like, do you think we're missing that right now?
Well, some people do it. I think the top players can certainly gain some small percentages by doing this, mm-hmm. and I feel that they still don't really do it enough. On the other hand, like, Magic is also a game that many people can play in different ways, and if you just play it for fun, like casually, and care mostly about just having nice games, then you may not be interested in, like, spending several hours trying to figure out the exact perfect mana base. Not really something that may be that enjoyable for people. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't mind if some more scientific approaches would be used to Magic more frequently. It's something that I enjoy, that I like when other people do it and see how they approach it exactly, and where I think there is still some opportunity for growth within the Magic community.
Sure, Sure. So enough about the community. Let's talk about you, Mr. Carson. Now, from what I was able to determine, you are widely regarded as being one of the greatest minds in Magic the Gathering. You're not just known for being good at the game, you're known for your brain, you're known for your smarts. How does it feel when people say that about you, one of the greatest minds in Magic? Do you agree with that?
Well, it's a nice compliment to get, and obviously it feels good to be recognized for that. Well, at the same time, though, I have to say that generally speaking, the Magic community, and I guess the pro Magic community in general, just consists of a pretty smart bunch of people. So when I'm at a pro tour, for example, then I usually don't even feel like I'm the smartest guy in the room, or even spend much time thinking about that, really. So, well, I'm aware, I'm intelligent. Otherwise, I also would have never been able to obtain a PhD. But I'm by no means the only smart person in the Magic community. I guess I've just spent more time writing about my analytical approach to the game, and I'm happy that many people have enjoyed reading them. But I guess that's the main thing where my reputation stems from.
Okay. And you grew up in the Netherlands. You're actually calling me from the Netherlands now, right?
Yep. Okay. Aloha.
Okay. What was your childhood like growing up in the Netherlands? Like, what were you like as a kid?
Well, so I grew up in Heerlen, a city in the south of the Netherlands, in a happy family. I had like one younger brother. In school, I was often scoring like high grades. Even skipped like a class when I was 8 or so.
Wow.
And I was always interested in games, from video games, mostly the more strategic ones, stuff like Civilization and things like that. But also games like chess, various card games. So I always enjoyed those a lot, the ones with some kind of intellectual challenge. And also the circle of friends that I was with when I was young were also pretty high on games, and it formed like a big part of what we did together. And then there was Magic. So with Magic, I discovered it when I was like 13, I believe. Stan van der Velden, or Stan van der Velden, as he's called in the US, who was a good friend of mine back then. He was taught the game by a friend of his, and well, he also showed it. Then at first I was like, well, this seems like fun, but you know, it's pretty expensive, so I'm not really sure, and nah. But then again, I figured it was a lot of fun, so I did buy into it, and obviously
I'm
glad that I did. And well, we started playing like first a bit casually with just a group of people, I think, as most people start, and then yeah, bit by bit we started playing more. I mean, at first like a pre-released, and some of us discovered, oh, at the local store there is a pre-release, and we're like, oh, what's a pre-release? Oh, new set coming out. So then we went to that tournament.
Now, was that back when pre-releases were big deals, that they weren't just at the local store and you could get like hundreds of people, or were they smaller back then?
No, they were pretty big. Not hundreds of people where I played, but like 100 people easily showed up.
Okay. And maybe that's an American thing, but I seem to recall, you know, back in the day, you know, they were almost like mini opens, you know, like you would get a room bigger than your local game store, and they would be big deals.
Yeah. I think also back then, most of the stores were pretty small. So they just rented out some spaces in like not complete convention centers, but like cafes with like some space for playing games, and there those tournaments were held. But yeah, it's always nice when you're starting out on the game to see like a gathering of people who come together and like play this. And I did reasonably well at those early tournaments that I played, and it kind of fueled the drive for, hey, there's like a bigger world magic wise out there, and let's see how it goes.
Now, I want to go back a little bit, because you said that you were into games as a kid. You know, did you look at them with the same through the same lens that you did today, where you were looking at them from a mathematical probability standpoint? Like, were you into that as a kid?
Well, I think at that point, I wasn't even aware of the concept of a probability. Mm-hmm. That wasn't taught to me until way later. Maybe intuitively, I'd always tried to kind of figure out the rules and play as well as I could, and I guess look ahead when playing chess, read up on those games to try to become as well as I could. But as far as when it comes to like mathematics, not when I was so young.
Mm-hmm. Were you into math as a kid? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, not much more than like languages or other subjects, which is one of the many things that I liked. Mm-hmm. It's just something that I got into a bit later in life.
It's interesting whenever I hear people say they enjoy math, because I'm so bad at math, I just can't imagine it ever being fun. And I know my friend Matt is a level 2 judge, and he teaches math. And, you know, he will leave these Facebook updates where he's genuinely having a good time writing curriculums and writing things. He's like, "Ooh, I get to work on a trigonometry exam." But I'm like, you need to get out a little more, because this is not supposed to be fun. And God bless him. I love people that, you know, love what they love, but I just can't. I don't understand.
Well, it kind of depends on how you approach it. Just a pure trigonometry problem is not all that much fun by itself. Mm-hmm. But when you start applying it to stuff, well, I guess trigonometry is not really the best example, actually, because I've never really seen that much interesting applications for it. But say probabilities, that's something that I became very much interested in, because I kind of saw the applications to the games that I enjoyed, and then suddenly everything starts to come alive. And well, if you enjoy solving puzzles, then certain aspects of mathematics can also be just like that.
Mm-hmm. I think I seem to recall I was researching you for the show, and I discovered your thesis, which we'll talk about a little later. And I seem to recall in one of the opening pages you admit, and I don't remember the exact phrasing, but you said something along the lines that beauty can be found in mathematical process. Mm-hmm. And I remember kind of going, Frank, you got to sell me on this one, because I'm just not sure what you mean by that. But that, yeah, you do love math, and I really get that from you.
Well, it's kind of elegance and simplicity, which you can get via like formal definitions as well as some mathematical theorems. It's, well, in a way, a certain work of art. Mm-hmm. And well, I can see the beauty in that.
That's so interesting.
I've never tried to sell people on it, though, so I'm not sure I will succeed in that. But at least I'm seeing the beauty in it and the fun and how much I enjoy it. So at least there's that.
That's wonderful. So you went to your first couple events. You seemed to do okay. It sounds like you got bit by the bug, like you wanted to keep going.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. So... well, early on, like a year after I learned about the game, Stan van der Velden and I quite frequently went to various tournaments in the Netherlands. And this is a very small country, so you can basically reach everything in like 2 hours by train. Mm. So then we might like take a train on Saturday morning, go to a tournament in Amsterdam or something, then spend the night from Saturday to Sunday at some uncle or aunt who we hadn't really seen in 2 years or so, but who lived nearby and was willing to put us up for a night. And then the next day we would like travel to, I don't know, a tournament in a nearby city and then travel back home again.
That sounds convenient.
And, yeah, it was a lot of fun, a good time. And I mean, the more you play, the better you get.
Yeah.
And well, after some experience, like I eventually made it to the top eight of my first PDQ, where like I also had to call my my mom and dad, like saying, "Hey, I'm here at this tournament, and I was originally planning to just take the last train home, but I'm now in the top eight, and I won't be able to take the last train home anymore. So I'm gonna stay here at like the house of Camille Cornelissen, who's willing to put me up, and I'll try to win. Okay, thanks, bye." So I'm like, well, okay.
How old were you when you made that phone call?
14 or 15.
Wow.
But they were pretty pretty accommodating.
Okay.
They placed a lot of faith in me, gave me lots of freedom, mm-hmm. and I'm thankful for that, and I think I handled it pretty well.
Well, it sounds like you didn't give him much choice in that phone call. You were like, "Hey, mom, I'm going to win this PTQ. Bye."
I guess I gave him a little more than that, but yeah. At least I think I did ask.
Yeah.
But it was a situation where if they had told me no, I'm not really sure what I would have done at that point.
Could have changed everything.
maybe. Yeah. Though I didn't actually win that PTQ.
I think I remember reading that in one of your articles. I think you even said, you know, "I've never won a PTQ. I'm the only pro tour. You know, I'm one of the pro tour folks who's never won a PTQ." And
that's true.
I
finished second at a two slotter PDQ, mm-hmm. but it didn't count as winning. I've won like team PDQs, but that also doesn't really count. Mm-hmm. But the way I got to the Pro Tour was just via Grand Prix and Nationals. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've never won a PDQ or any big tournament in my life. Not even a GP or a Pro Tour. Which always surprises people, and it always makes for like a nice guessing game for people to ask when they are wondering about like the past, like how many PDQ, GP and PT wins do I have together, and are people guessing like one, maybe two, could it be three, and no one ever thinks it's zero, but it is. You don't have to actually win tournaments in order to do well at tournaments.
Mm, that's good advice right there. Now, did your parents continue to support you as you went on the ride, like as you got better at the game? Like they were totally fine with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they were mainly happy that I found something that I enjoyed and that I could put my passions in.
Okay.
And that was also shared by just a great group of people. I did have to convince them to allow them to, well, allow me to go to a pro tour abroad, when I was fairly young still, but well, that all worked out. Mm-hmm. Like the first time I went to a pro tour, that was actually Worlds in Brussels in 2000. I was like 16. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing was that Brussels was just like a couple hours by train from where I lived, so not really all that far. Didn't have to take a plane, so they with they being my parents were okay with it. And then later when I qualified for my first pro tour, which was in New York, well, I had to take a plane, and they were a bit, understandably, a bit not really scared, but worried maybe that, yeah, like their 16-year-old son would take a plane with some other people to New York all by themselves, and then have like a group of like 16-year-old people being in New York by themselves and trying to figure everything out. But they once again gave me that that freedom. I was also happy that my school was accommodating. I could just get a week off of high school. Stan van der Velden and I together, actually, we were in the same class. So yeah, and then everything kind of worked out because we came back alive.
Definite plus. But you were 16 years old when you qualified for your first pro tour. What is that like? Like, wow.
Well, back then it was actually normal. Like in 2000 or so, I think the average age on the pro tour may have been maybe 20 years or something like that.
Wow.
And especially in the Netherlands, the average age of the Dutch person on the pro tour was, well, it might have been 18 or something like that. Mm. Lots of, well, the people who are currently, say, in the Hall of Fame from the Netherlands, but also many of the other Dutch players who had been around at Pro Tour for a while, which is pretty young people, maybe like first year college students or people in high school still like me. And the same also held for people from other countries. Back then it was a pretty young crowd. We were also very much surprised when we tried to order a beer in the US, where all of us were like allowed to drink beer back at home. But there, I think only one or two of the 10 Dutch players there were allowed to order a beer because, I mean, there it's 21 years old. Mm-hmm. But like nowadays, the average age on the pro tour is certainly higher.
Yeah.
But I think in large part, it's just the same people who were there like 10 years ago, mm-hmm. also including people like John Finkel and Kai Budde. They're still playing today, and well, obviously they've grown older. Mm-hmm. And just the general average age of the Magic player nowadays is just higher than it used to be.
Yeah.
So it wasn't all that special, but still required some convincing of my parents to allow me to go to the PTs when I was 16. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when Jacob Wilson showed up at the Pro Tour in Valencia recently, and I remember they made a big kerfuffle about his age and how young he was and how, you know, well he was doing. And yeah, I feel like we just don't see those young guys anymore breaking through, which I love to see. But yeah, we just don't anymore. But I love looking back at the pictures. Like, I have had a number of you Hall of Famers on my show, and I do my research, and seeing how young Kai was and seeing how young Chapin was and how young you were, and you guys were kids. Like, you were this tiny little thing. Like, I saw your pictures. And you, I didn't even recognize you. I was like, who is that kid? You had these little arms. And yeah, it's just crazy to watch that. And just, it's such a different time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I always have a lot of fun trying to look back at pictures of all the Dutch people from back then. Because, yeah, it's just like really looking back into the past and how young and small we all were. Good times, good times. Yeah.
Another thing I noticed about you, you are also a ginger, correct?
Yes.
Yes, yes. I noticed that. Like, I, in addition to noticing how young you were, Frank, I was like, damn, he's pale.
Yeah, it's true.
Which I can relate to. So good to have you on Team Ginge. It's good to hear.
Yeah, I've never really been one to venture into the sun. If I'm just in the sun for like half an hour or something, I grow from completely pale to lobster red, and then like an hour later, I'm just like completely black, charcoaled. It's horrible. So when we anytime we see there's a Pro Tour Honolulu once again. On the one hand, I think this is gonna be nice. On the other hand, I think better pack an entire suitcase full of sunscreen, otherwise, yeah.
I know there's been talk of when GP Vegas was a thing, and there's another GP Vegas coming too, it was the same thing. People were like, hey, Aaron, you going to Vegas? And I'm like, I don't really keep well in the heat. I'm kind of like leftovers. I need to be in tight, cool spaces, just with no light. That's the excuse.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that.
So your first pro tour, though, you had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you learn a lot?
Well, yes. Also in large part, like how I guess my skills stacked up to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And, well, also obviously improved my own playing skills by playing against better people, seeing how these big tournaments worked, learning how to travel to a foreign country. One way or another, I think whether or not I would have done well at the Pro Tour, I certainly learned a lot, but I did do reasonably well, so that definitely fueled my drive for trying to do even better.
And you finished 17th at your first Pro Tour, correct?
Yes.
That's not bad.
No, no.
Yeah.
It's also it was a nice follow-up to, I think, my 9th place finish at the European Championships. Mm-hmm. Like, back then we still had championships for every continent.
Yeah.
Finished 9th there. There was only like a couple months before that. Mm-hmm. So, well, at that point it's also easy to think, I'm doing really well at these tournaments. I kind of deserve to keep this up, to do well at future tournaments as well. But I didn't actually do all that well at the next couple of PTs that I played at. I don't think I even finished in the money. So maybe I was a little lucky in the first couple of events that I played. Mm-hmm. The ones after that kind of also told me that I certainly wasn't winning all the time, and that there were still lots of great people in the game who were just still better than I was, mm-hmm. Which obviously inspired me to become better.
Yeah, and then you did. So you get 16th place at Pro Tour Venice, and then 10th in San Diego, 5th in Boston, and then you make your first top 8 in Nagoya. And it seems like there was some tangible improvement there. Like, you could really point to that and say, I am getting better at this. Would you agree with that?
Yes, when it comes to results, for sure. Mm-hmm. Besides just improving on my best finish from time to time, I also started seeing an improvement in kind of my average finish. Mm-hmm. After a couple of years on the PT, I was quite frequently finishing quite deeply into the money, and like finishing in an unspectacular though decent like 50th or 40th place was starting to get referred to as the Frank Carsten finish within Dutch circles. Like, Frank consistently finished somewhere in the money once again, but is never making top 8 or winning anything at all. It definitely felt good to see an improvement over the years. And not just seeing an improvement in best results, which is nice by itself, but doesn't count for all that much, mm-hmm. but rather an improvement in how well I felt I was playing, and how much about the game I was learning. Mm-hmm. I derived more enjoyment from like feeling that I was getting better at the game than like finishing highly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, eventually that started to happen as well.
Are you able to say that? Like, let's say you go to a GP or you go to a Pro Tour, and like you said, maybe you didn't have the best results, but are you able to still say, even though I didn't do as well as I would have liked to, I learned this or I learned that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. If I learn something useful, then I'm always happy. Mm-hmm. When I look back at a tournament, I'm feeling a little happier when I feel like I played extremely well, even if I didn't finish highly enough, than when I felt I didn't really play as well as I could, but maybe finished in the top 8, for example.
Now, speaking of Nagoya, this was one of the more noteworthy moments in your career happened at this event. You showed up with something called the List, which helped give you this reputation as a bit of a mad scientist of magic. So for those who don't know, what was the List and why was it such a big deal?
So Proto Nagoya was draft.
Okay.
Back then we just had single format Pro Tours. And to prepare for the tournament, I made this list in which I ranked all the cards in the set from high to low for like pick order decisions. The main purpose of the list was mainly to kind of facilitate some discussion, because what I noticed at previous tournaments was that, well, there were discussions about cards between pro players, but they were more like, "Hey, what do you think of this card?" And then someone would say, "Yeah, I like it," but yeah, you don't really learn anything from that. It's more important to figure out, okay, when you have these two cards in the pack, well, which one do you like better in general, or like for the first pick, first pack decision. So I drew up a list and I just started going around and like asking people, like, take a look at this this order that I have. Do you think cards are ranked a bit more highly than they should, or do you think I am completely underrating a card? And that was very valuable. So I learned a lot from that discussion. Hopefully others learned a bit from it as well. And yeah, when the tournament started, I had this this list where indeed I ranked all the cards from high to low based on my own ideas as well as those of others. I didn't really adhere to it like every single pick. Obviously, drafting a deck is also important, but it definitely gave like a baseline. It was also fun to see that list. It was basically just like two pieces of paper with like some card names, lots of cards crossed out, put in somewhere, 15,000 arrows showing, no, this card should go in between those. And it was kind of a complete mess to see. It started to get close to indecipherable, actually. But, well, it definitely helped me get a grasp on the limited format. And, yeah, I actually did make top 8 there.
Mm-hmm. Now, was it something that you shared with people, like you made copies of it, or it was just yours, and did you have it with you while you were drafting?
Well, I certainly shared it with like all the Dutch players.
Okay.
Like back then, we also had a lot of Dutch players on the train for several years, actually. So for every pro tour, let's say between 2000 and 2006 or so, there were like 10 to 15 Dutch players qualified, maybe like 8, 9 or 10 of them were just on the gravy train, which is what we would call gold level these days, just qualified for all the pro tours. And then some PDQ winners from our country were GP top 8 competitors who qualified for the pro tour as well, and who we just took up into our testing group. And travel group. It was kind of like one of the super teams that we have these days, like Channel Fireball or Channel Fireball Pantheon. But then just located within a country where all the people were kind of bonded together by, on the one hand, the same language, and on the other hand, also just usually knowing each other, because it's such a small country. So most people know all the other top Magic players in the country. Mm-hmm. But basically we all flew together to the tournament, like stayed at the same hotels, and within that entire process of traveling, I definitely talked to most of the people there to gather their ideas on the list, and certainly also, well, I didn't make copies. As I mentioned, it was just like a handwritten thing. Mm-hmm. But definitely passed it around and used it to foster some discussion while we were at dinners or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Do you still have the list?
I don't. I think I have a picture of it.
Okay.
But the actual physical thing, no, it didn't really stand the test of time.
Oh, I love seeing that. I know Kibler's known for posting these old pictures that he actually still has, I think, his notebooks from back when, and he will post these handwritten deck lists from back in the day. And I love that. I think they're like relics, and I'm always a fan of people keeping them and maybe even like auctioning them someday. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I kind of regret not saving all of those things. I'm also really lacking some pictures from way back then. I got my collection of pictures that I have on my computer right now is starting in like 2005, 2006. Whereas, I mean, it was also kind of around the advent of digital cameras and whatnot. But before that, well, obviously had made some pictures and then kept some papers from back then, but didn't really store them or value them all that much. And looking back now, I kind of miss that I haven't really cherished those relics. There was also like, for example, one picture that I knew was kind of special, but that I also lost maybe due to carelessness, which was of a completely empty Times Square. This was like from like 2001, when 9/11 happened at in New York. There was actually a pro tour the weekend before.
Oh, really?
Yes, and well, I and many other people were there as well. So many people flew back on Monday, and then everything was fine. But like I and some other Dutch players there decided to, well, let's stay another day in New York, do some sightseeing. I mean, we're not here every time; it's a special city, so let's just walk around. And then, well, all of a sudden, our plans of visiting the World Trade Center, well, unfortunately, didn't go through anymore because, well. 9/11 happened.
So you were in New York when that happened?
Yes,
Wow.
where I had actually sent a message to my parents the night before, saying, "Hey, everything is okay here." Typing from an internet cafe right now, because obviously this is when cell phones and so on weren't even around everywhere. And well. Times are good here. We're planning to go to the World Trade Center tomorrow morning and do some sightseeing there. So they were kind of freaking out when they heard the news. But well, eventually we got a hold of them and explained that at least we were all okay. But then yeah, we were kind of stuck in New York for a week or so because well all the planes were grounded. And the entire city was suddenly completely desolate. Like there was no one there anymore. Everyone just left. Then we could just walk around and stand on Times Square and not see a single car from any direction. And for those kinds of experiences, I kind of regret not keeping onto all the things that I had back then. We actually stayed at the Alex Schwartzman's place, another Magic player from the New York area for a week. Just did a bunch of drafts before we could eventually fly back home again. So we kind of made the best out of it and indeed just did a lot of drafts. But it's one of those crazy experiences that you get when you travel for Magic tournaments.
So another highly talked about moment from your career is Pro Tour Yokohama and the bucket.
Oh yeah.
What's up with the bucket?
Well, so in Yokohama, after playing day one, I was doing reasonably well. Maybe I went like 6-2 or something. And I had tested a lot for the tournament. I felt I had a really good deck. But then in the night, from day one to day two, I fell ill. Maybe I ate something bad, or well, I'm still not sure what really had befallen me.
It was
But
poisoning.
well, yeah, maybe fellow competitors saw my rising up in the standings and they decided to poison me. Well, that would be a first. But they didn't actually succeed because I still decided to show up. Ha! Got him. No, but like the guy was kind of really sick the entire night, just spending the entire night puking. And then at that morning, I was like, okay, I can stay in bed for another day, as most sick people would do, or because I mean, I'm already ranked quite highly in the tournament. I spend a lot of time preparing. I kind of want to do well. Just go to the tournament anyway and see how well I would do. But just as a precaution, I brought like a bucket from the hotel room with me. Otherwise, I mean, I have felt it might have been a bit inconsiderate to start puking all over the tournament hall.
Now, when you say bucket, do you mean like the garbage container, the ice bucket? Like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, kind of a garbage container. I think it was the actual garbage container from the hotel room.
Wow.
But yeah, I started playing. I think at some point I had to actually use the thing, though. I ran out to the restroom to use it there. And well, afterwards also Sheldon Mannery, who was the head judge back then, came up to me and told me, "Well, Frank, if you have to use this thing one more time during the tournament, we will have to ask you to drop,"
Oh no.
which I felt was well reasonable.
I would have loved to have heard you try to argue that one. Like, I can keep going with this bucket of
No.
vomit in your hand. Like,
No, but at least Sheldon was accommodating. He gave me some pills and obviously hoped that I would feel better again. So in between rounds, I was just like lying on a chair, hating the way I felt. Some of the Dutch players helped me out a bit, gave me some water. But then, yeah, I was like spending the time in between rounds kind of passed out. And then when the pairings came up, well, I was up there again and kind of with a tableside bucket, my head in my hands, feeling nauseous and sick, but still managing to think and concentrate at least somewhat reasonably during the games. I kept on winning. There was also one round where I was paired against Gabriel Nassif, who was wearing a very unsympathetic shirt of a clown puking rainbows. So that was kind of inappropriate in that match.
And did he wear it knowing you were sick? Like, okay.
No. He just showed up with that during the day. It was just funny to see how that matched up. And then I think there was also one match against Guillaume Wafutapa, who eventually won the tournament, where I was told by other people that he was playing just a mono blue control deck with lots of card draw and counter magic.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. Are you saying that Waka Flocka was playing a control deck? He doesn't do that.
It felt completely reasonable, and well, it's just what Wafutapa does every time, like
Oh, I know,
tricky
that's why I
hybrid
was poking
spells,
fun
tricky
at
lands. Well, that's it.
it.
But like I wasn't able to watch any of his matches, so I was just going by what other people told me. And then at some point he really got me by, I think I played an Urborg to turn all of his to turn everyone's lands into swamps. I attacked with a Negator Totem, which was a creature that if it was dealt damage, I would have to sacrifice that many permanents.
Yeah.
And then he just suddenly had Tendrils of Corruption after all, which I wasn't expecting at all, which meant that by the way I played, I just gave him the opportunity to use his card to force me to sacrifice like four of my lands, which was one of the situations where people were thinking, well, if there's ever a chance to puke in the bucket, it's right then. Such a devastating blowout. But I still kept my composure and played on. And well, I finished that tournament in ninth place, missing the last round for top eight. And I think afterwards I went back to the hotel room and well, just slept for a long time. Also plenty of people who told me, yeah, I would have never shown up at the tournament when I was this sick. And they thought I was a bit crazy for doing it. But like when I worked a lot to find a good deck and had a good opportunity to get a nice finish, I wasn't really letting my own body get in the way. And I'm not sure it was really wise to do what I did, but I'm happy that I managed to succeed there, and that I didn't actually puke over any competitor.
It's definitely good motivation for other people. Like, I know I was watching Worlds the other day, and I think Raph Levy had sent a tweet out, and he said, if Wizards can advertise Magic Online, then you can go ahead and ask that girl out. And I can see changing it to, if Frank Carson can go ninth at a tournament puking in a bucket, then you can go to that GP with the sniffles. Like,
yep.
It'd be a nice little motivational poster, almost like in America we have the Uncle Sam poster where he points at you and he's like, I want you. Like, we can put Frank Carson on it where it's like, if I can puke in a bucket, you can go. And
yeah, well,
I would, yeah.
It might make for a good playmat.
Yeah. I would buy that playmat. Set it up.
I should start making this.
Yeah.
It was also like an idea by Riley Knight, yeah. like new commentator on the European team,
yeah.
Was telling me that I should make kind of like a playmat with the same pose as Brian Kibler lounging, but then holding some tables for mana bases.
Yeah.
Something like that. yeah, just making something different.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And then the ballot goes out for the Class of 2009 Hall of Fame. And did you feel like that was your year to get in?
Yes, because the clause was relatively weak, at least when compared to the years after that. I felt I had a reasonable chance of getting in with like some decent finishes at Pro Tours and Grand Prix, but also having contributed a lot to the community, mainly by writing articles for a long time, mm-hmm. and sharing my ideas. But I did feel like if I wasn't getting in that year, that I would have a harder time getting in next year's, because the competition then was higher.
Mm-hmm. Was it always your plan to get in the Hall of Fame?
Well, no. When I started playing, it didn't even exist. Mm-hmm. I think it was started in 2005 or something. And when it was first announced, I was like, well, I've been playing for a couple of years. I don't even have a Pro Tour Top 8 right now. I'm probably never gonna make this Hall of Fame thing. Though it seemed like a beautiful honor to get. I did change my mind after like making some Top 8s at tournaments and becoming more well recognized. Mm-hmm. Then I indeed put it as kind of a goal for myself, like I hope to be voted into the Hall of Fame. So it was like awesome news that I learned that I was voted in.
How did you find out that you were in?
Well, I got a phone call from Scott Larrabee, which I think went something like me picking up and saying, ja, hallo, goedemiddag, met Frank. And he's like, hello, I'm looking for Frank Arsten. Like, yeah, that's me. But yeah, then he told me kind of a week before it was announced that I indeed had made it. And yeah, that was just an awesome feeling, because I figured it would be close either way. And well, making it, seeing that enough members of the Magic community had, I guess, honored my accomplishments was, yeah, wonderful.
Yeah. And what is your relationship with Magic like after being inducted into the Hall of Fame? Like, do you still have goals in the game that you'd like to achieve, or do you feel like maybe you can rest a little bit?
Well, I certainly rested for a little bit. Mm-hmm. At that point, I was also starting my PhD project, which took up, well, a lot of time. That was essentially like a full-time job. So I didn't have as much time for Magic as I used to have. And at the same time, after playing for 10 years or so at the highest level, I was also looking for some other challenges in life. So at that point, I was really happy to be in the Hall of Fame, such that I didn't have to go through the grind every year to get enough points to qualify for all the pro tours. Mm-hmm. And I also just took it easy for a couple of years. Like, I played one or two pro tours a year, even showed up with like Highlander decks just to have fun. because, well, I didn't really have to win to stay on the train. So I figured I might as well do something fun, put out a new challenge, like try to make the top eight of a pro tour with all singletons. I actually did reasonably well with that, yeah. Though I didn't make it to the top eight, unfortunately. So just, had fun for a while, even though I still, in the back of my head, I still had the goal of, I would like to win a tournament for a change, like either a GP or a PT. I mean, I've been in the top eight many times. I finished second place, but I've never actually won a tournament, and that's a goal that I still have, especially after I started playing a bit more actively, say a year ago.
Mm-hmm. And last year you received your doctoral degree. Are you literally a doctor now?
Yes.
Okay, so you're Dr. Frank Karsten.
Yeah, you may call me that. That's or as Riley Knight always used to say on the European coverage. There he is again, Frank Karsten, the good doctor. I'm not really sure whether there are people who are bad doctors or anything like that. But yes, I obtained my PhD in kind of a mathematical field indeed.
Wow, congratulations. That is a huge deal.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I read, like I said, I discovered your thesis, and it was called Resource Pooling Games. Mm-hmm. And you touched on Magic a little bit. So for those who don't know, what was your thesis about? Like, break it down for me.
Well, if because this is like a Magic podcast as well, I might as well explain it with an example that I put in my thesis, which was on four wizards. John, Kai, Gabriel, and Olivier, who all want to cast Lightning Helix. Yes, even in like a formal PhD thesis, I managed to put in some nonsense to explain it. But basically, the idea here is that you have these four wizards. They all want to cast Lightning Helix, and to do so, well, they need one white and one red mana. Mm-hmm. And they can get it by buying Black Lotuses, let's say at $1,000 a piece or something.
Sure.
But every Black Lotus, you can get either three red mana or three white mana. So if you're just one wizard and you would want to cast one Lightning Helix, then you would have to buy two Black Lotus for a lot of money, and then, well, the excess mana would just go away. Whereas if you collaborate with the other wizards, like buy two Black Lotuses together, then you can cast Lightning Helix, the both of you, from like the same amount of Black Lotuses. Mm-hmm. So there are that's an example of resource pooling. But then the question that you get, especially when you have multiple people who each want to cast like a different number of helixes, is well, suppose we all work together and like buy Black Lotuses together. How are we going to allocate those costs amongst all of the participants? Mm-hmm. Like somehow you want to force people who need more mana to pay a bit more, but how much exactly, and how are you going to do that? That was kind of the original question. Now, obviously, in my thesis, I am more inspired by practical applications like, for example, retail stores who want to share inventories against uncertain demands or something like that. So it kind of turns into the mathematical combination of queuing theory and cooperative game theory, where I try to put these kind of problems in mathematical terms, turn it into a formal model, and then prove all kinds of theorems on, well, what could happen and what the properties are, how you can assign costs in a fair way in those situations. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I had been working on for a couple of years. And,
okay.
Well, it turned out to be a nice thesis that even my committee, despite all the references to wizards casting lightning helixes, and I had some stories about Scrooge McDuck and Gyro Gearloose and whatnot in there as well, they still allowed me to pass.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that you do outside of magic? You got the shiny degree. What do you do? Like, what's your job?
Well, a lot of time currently goes into magic, like playing all the tournaments, preparing for the tournaments, doing writing of articles, doing event coverage. Next to that, I recently started like a part-time job as a business intelligence consultant.
Mm-hmm.
This was in a very small company with four people, actually spearheaded by another magic player, Victor, who I was actually stuck with in New York in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow that contact has always stayed warm. And well, I just do some mathematical modeling and data analysis for them. I recently started that. It's okay so far, but I'm not really sure where I would want to be in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was also fairly difficult to find a job that could accommodate my request for working very much part-time, because I wanted to do all the magic-related stuff next to it. I wanted to have like 12 weeks of holiday in a year to go to all the pro tours.
Wait a minute, you get 12 weeks of holiday?
Well, that's what I agreed with them contractually.
Wow, I was happy that I got an extra week this year for 4 weeks, and I was ready to jump up and click my heels. 12 weeks.
Well, I kind of need that if I want to go to all the pro tours and prepare for them.
12 weeks. I need a bucket. Just hearing that, where's my bucket? Like, I don't get that much time off.
Well, it's not even all that much time off, because obviously in those weeks in a way, preparing for the Pro Tour and playing the Pro Tour is kind of working as well. At least, it's a lot of fun work. It may feel more like a work to me, because, well, I've been, I'm not even sure how many Pro Tours I played, but it's maybe around 50 or 60 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not super super special holiday as it would be maybe for like a first timer.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I definitely needed those weeks off, otherwise I couldn't attend all the pro tours anymore. Mm-hmm. But that's also why I was happy that Victor, who also played Magic for a while, kind of understood what I wanted and was happy to accommodate still.
Yeah. Do you have any plans to go to the Pro Tour in October of 2015? It's going to be in my hometown, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I was planning to go there for sure. That's in the new season, right?
Yeah, I believe so. But still, it'd be awesome to meet Frank Karsten and buy you a beer.
I'll be glad to take you up on that. for the new season, I'm not 100% sure whether I will go to all the Pro Tours. I was planning to kind of reevaluate after the, I think, Pro Tour M16.
Mm-hmm.
Might also depend on how how the team that I'm currently working with like mostly a bunch of Europeans, Czechs and Slovaks in particular, are doing, what I want to do in life, because I frankly don't really know where I would want to be in 5 years and what kind of career I really enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. But there's a really high probability that I will still go to that Pro Tour, and I'll definitely take you up on the beer.
Super, super. I'm excited that it's going to be in my hometown. I plan on getting like an unmarked van, and I'm going to case the place and find like the house, and I'll send one of you in with a wire, and I'll have binoculars. It'll be like a big, you know, big operation. It'll be awesome. Boom, 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 boom. It'd be great.
Well, yeah, it sounds like fun. Yeah.
I know. I can't wait. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Like I said, this has been an absolute pleasure. I've enjoyed talking to you. And if people want to know more about you, Frank, and they want to get a hold of you, how can they do that? Where can they find you?
The easiest way would be on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It's at @Karsten_Frank. I'm also on Facebook. You can also find me there and shoot me a message.
Okay. And just so people know, there is also another Frank Karsten out there who's really into like politics and freedom and writes books, and that's not you. So don't get confused.
No, it's not. This is indeed a little confusing. I think even if you like if you search on Amazon, you get books by that guy, who is also from the Netherlands.
Yeah.
But it's not me.
Yeah, because I was researching you, and I remember I started off a general Google search, and I was writing my notes. I have a little notepad. I'm like, Frank Karsten, Hall of Fame. Oh, he wrote a book. This is so wonderful. So I write down book, and then I write, oh, and he cares about his people. He's political. Okay. And then I'm like, oh, that's not him.
that saw a picture maybe.
Yeah. And to be fair, I mean, you are cuter than the other Frank Karsten. Just saying. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Glad to have been here. It's been
absolutely
fun.
Absolutely. And if anybody's enjoyed what they've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. You can keep up with the show on Twitter at The Deck Tees. You can follow me on Twitter at Original Estrus. And you can also email the show at thedecktees@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.